This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry, with Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, general manager of Tabor Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Hi there, this is Addison Snell from Tabor Research, and I'm with Michael Feldman, the editor of HPC Wire. How's it going, Michael?
Pretty good, Addison. How are you doing?
Doing great. We've had another good week in the news this week, and on our call today, I know we're going to be talking about this new government report from the World Technology Evaluation Center about U.S. use of simulation-based engineering and science, and how that pertains to some areas, including the ISV community. But I know that first we wanted to talk about NVIDIA's news with their new GPU-based clusters with Tesla. What did you think of that news?
Yeah, that was pretty big news this week. It was totally unexpected, and I thought it was a pretty logical step for NVIDIA. I was half expecting them to come out with something like this, since they did essentially the same thing for the personal workstation systems, where they partnered up with OEMs and system builders and resellers and sort of offered these semi-standardized GPU-accelerated systems. But in this case, in this week's news, they did it with clusters. They took their cluster product, they signed up a bunch of OEMs like Cray and Colfax and Apro, and said, okay, we're gonna deliver pre-configured GPU clusters to the market, and this is what they're going to look like, essentially, and here's sort of the guidelines on what they want to look like, and here's the software stack, and so on. And so it was a pretty reasonable thing to do, but also a pretty smart thing to do, because NVIDIA doesn't have to do a whole lot here except sign up the OEMs. They leverage their hardware, their CUDA that they've introduced, and all of a sudden they've got now a dozen or more cluster vendors selling their products out there. So it was a good move for them, and like I said, not totally unexpected. It just sort of reflects sort of the logical, methodical way NVIDIA is sort of pursuing this market. But what do you think about it?
Well, I agree with that, and I think it helps for them to guide their OEMs in terms of these are how we're going to build these clusters, because a critical barrier for GPU adoption is the software development component. Now, NVIDIA has been very strong with CUDA in terms of making that easier for people to do. And that started with their at the low end with their personal supercomputers, as you pointed out, and now they're trying to bring that up to a more scalable level of clusters. The ongoing challenge is still going to be get the applications on there, and I think it's a difficult task for ISVs in particular, because it's not clear to me what the business case is for them. You're going to go to an ISV and explain to them how they can put a lot of work into a new paradigm in which they're going to make less money. That's a tough one unless you figure out what's in it for the ISV to do that. I will mention with the personal supercomputers that I still don't love exactly how they're bringing those to market. And you inadvertently referred to it yourself as a personal workstation. I think that designator makes a lot more sense than calling it a personal supercomputer. First of all, they're going to get in their own way with the oxymoron personal supercomputer. Anyone who wants a supercomputer doesn't really want it to be personal. And for those who do want it, calling it a personal supercomputer is going to get in the way of procurement, right? You're going to explain to your manager, I'm going to buy Jim his own personal supercomputer. You're going to want, you will not, right? It doesn't work. But this is essentially the same as what we looked at as technical workstations 10 years ago. It's a multi-core system. It runs Linux. It's 64-bit. It's got two GPUs that you can use either for acceleration or for rendering. I don't know why they won't just call it a workstation. This is a workstation category system. And if you notice with Dell now bundling NVIDIA GPUs into their systems, Dell is calling it a workstation. So it makes a little more sense to me.
No, I think it does make sense to call it a workstation. And I don't know if NVIDIA is actually pushing that as a marketing tool so much. The press picks up on it, and I'm as guilty as the next guy, I guess. But yeah, to call it a supercomputer, I think you sort of have to differentiate it from the systems that they announced this week, which are more in that category. They scale up to, you know, hundreds of nodes of clusters that with GPU server boards attached, and you get something in the hundreds of teraflop range, and that's something more like a supercomputer. So, yeah, maybe they do have sort of a little bit of a marketing problem there. And I do prefer the term workstations and GPU-accelerated workstations or whatever you want to call them. They're interesting enough just as they are. We don't have to call them supercomputers. I agree with you there.
Well, and to your point, they are building these systems that are more scalable now in clusters up through the mid-range and into the high end, and that should open the doors to some more flop-heavy calculations in tighter configurations, which, you know, really is very pertinent to this report that we're talking about with U.S. readiness and the worldwide state of simulation-based engineering and science. This report that came out from the from this government consortium. What do you think about that?
Right, I thought that was a very interesting report. They actually went to the trouble of mentioning NVIDIA and CUDA as part of their simulation and modeling technology they're finding, because this technology is spreading throughout the world, and it's things like the NVIDIA products and multi-core and just the general advancement of parallel computing technology that's making this hardware available to everybody. And I thought it made a couple of great points in the report, and that since basically I think there was a line in there that as far as the HPC community, the world is flat, or I should say, as far as the HPC hardware, the world has become flat, and now even countries of fairly modest means have access to all this hardware, so it's going to be the software that's going to be the differentiator. And the report basically brought out the fact that a lot of countries, a lot of smaller countries than us, are making strategic investments in software, and especially these simulation and modeling codes. And in some cases, they're doing more than what the U.S. is doing. There's countries like Japan and China and Germany that are looking at the simulation-based engineering and science and investing at universities, doing industry, government partnerships, and just getting a lot more traction out of this than maybe what the U.S. is doing.
Well, you're spot on there, Michael. I mean, when supercomputing was only all about the hardware and differentiated architectures, the U.S. was the indisputed king of the hill there, with Japan in a pretty clear second. But now that you have supercomputers being increasingly built by commodity components, you're right, it comes down to software. And it's not just some of the countries you mentioned, but also you know, places like India or Russia or Israel. India is a famous example where you look at within two generations what they've done with their investment in the India Institute of Technologies and bringing you know, a wide swath of their population through and turning them into software engineers. It's completely reinvented NVIDIA's economy in a 50-year span.
Right. Well, it's even smaller countries. There's like Finland, there's Sweden, Israel. I mean, even relatively small countries with just educated populations that make this type of investment can all of a sudden leapfrog whole generations of technology and all of a sudden become sort of leaders here. And that's part of what the report was about. Now, this was an SF-funded study. I did take exception to the fact that a lot of the theme behind this report was about how the U.S. was losing competitive advantage to some of these countries in certain areas. We still have a lot of technology expertise in these areas, obviously, but they were pointing to other countries that, in some cases, were surpassing us. And they were trying to make the point that we shouldn't lose this. We should be number one in these areas, but they didn't really make the case of why. In a few cases, they made the case about how the Department of Defense might lose access certain specific codes because of political considerations, that other countries didn't want to share certain software simulation codes with the Defense Department. But in the broader sense of economic competitiveness between countries, they didn't really connect the dots on why the U.S. needs to really remain number one in all these different areas. A lot of the problems that are behind simulation modeling, they're global problems there should be a lot of cooperation. It's like we cooperate with these other countries in different areas, in fusion programs, in certain health leadership programs. I'm not sure why there was so much emphasis on sort of this us versus them in this one technology area.
Well, I think they're also worried about how it pertains not only to military and defense, but to commerce. A lot of if you take the argument that HPC, driving science and engineering simulation, can improve R&D at a corporate level, and they'd like U.S. companies to be able to compete on a global commerce scale, then there's that consideration as well. You don't want to get to where if you're the NSF, you hate to get to where a lot of the leadership in R&D is going on outside of the country. And once you walk down that path, now you've got to be worried about whether U.S. universities are putting out the best and the brightest scientists and engineers for those companies to hire. So I think there's certainly that part of the landscape to look at.
Yeah, there is. Although today it's for most U.S.-based companies and even foreign-based companies, they're international. They have global footprints, and it's hard to really say that, you know, IBM or Toyota are U.S. or Japanese companies anymore. They have research facilities in multiple countries. They act as international conglomerates. It's not really clear how research done in one country or technology developed in one country doesn't automatically transfer throughout the whole world now. It's in the same way that the world is flat for hardware, I think it's also flat for, you know, software expertise, software itself, and all the other technologies that go along with it. So I think the leadership team was a little bit strained here. I think the world is flat, but I think it's even flatter than this report would lead you to believe. And I think the sort of us versus them bias is not really the way sort of to approach this problem in the long term. The world really is international, and the companies are going to increasingly become global companies, and the fact that, you know, they're based in New York or they're based in Tokyo is not going to really matter a whole lot as we go on.
Well, I think that's another excellent point, Michael, but the caution I would put both on that viewpoint and on this NSF report is that it's a little too tempting to get skewed by looking at the largest companies and the largest computers, what happens at this petaflop level of scale, where really a lot of the innovation that you have to worry about is in the entry level and mid-range. And I know there are areas of the government that are particularly concerned with how to encourage greater adoption at the entry level and mid-range of greater levels of simulation-based engineering and science, which is one of these points that's made within this report. And I think an area that maybe needs further exploration is what are the hurdles for those users, because they're in our research, we found hurdles that don't seem to be getting discussed. In particular, the creation of the first models to go into your first scalable simulations are a problem that can't be offloaded. You can buy Ansys or Fluent or Abacus or other off-the-shelf CAE programs, but no one is going to create for you the data that needs to get put into that program. And in particular, an area that's weak is the integration of CAD/CAM with CAE. A lot of these companies have CAD models, but taking the step that goes from having a CAD model to a scalable CAE model is a tough one to get over. And I'll mention quickly the press release that came out this week with Ansys and Autodesk, because they at least have started down that path towards standardization, where you can now take a standard Autodesk output and load it into Ansys, which I see as a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was an interesting note there from Ansys. Ansys is one of those. They are a large company there. I think they do have a global reach. But yeah, that was an interesting development. I think we're going to see more of that too. That more of that sort of collaboration and sort of that generalization in that market, where the larger IFVs are going to generalize this capability and reach into the HPC space and offer more of these kinds of capabilities.
That's an area where I'd love to see more development from the ISV community, from the middleware community, how to make that step from CAD to CAE. And it's also an area where I think if the government were going to invest in education, a program that would make a lot of sense would be to have coursework that partners seniors or graduate-level engineering students with nearby industry counterparts. And part of the coursework is to create these digital models that can be loaded into scalable ISV packages, maybe create a partially government-funded internship where the student works for the company. The company applies to join the program, get the intern. You're going to not only create the expertise and create the models that scale, but potentially add to the talent pool as the companies try to then hire these students who are coming out of these programs.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I think that partnerships might actually occur. The report that we mentioned was actually done before the current administration came in. I think it was started, the report was research was started in 2007, because there was no mention of the Obama administration's initiatives in these areas. But I think a lot of these government industry partnerships and educational programs are going to be put in place over the next couple of years as the stimulus money starts to hit the market. And it'll be interesting to see if the investment really takes place at the universities and colleges to sort of bump up the expertise there in these areas.
I agree with you, Michael. Best we can do is keep watching the news and see what happens next week, huh?
I agree with you there.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you again next week.
All right. So long, Anderson.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Download this podcast every Friday afternoon at www.hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.